Rebecca Ragg Sykes, thank you so much for coming on to Evolution Soup from your home in Wales, United Kingdom. You are a Paleolithic archaeologist specializing in Neanderthals, as well as a writer, having recently released a best-selling and critically acclaimed book all about Neanderthals entitled Kindred, Neanderthal Life, Love, Death, and Art, which describes a people that were not, as many still believe, dim-witted brutes, but rather emotional, artistic, and just as enlightened as Homo sapiens in their own way. So how are you doing, Rebecca? I know you've been very busy with interviews for your books, but also recently recording this here, an audio version of Kindred. So what was that like doing that?
Yeah, I'm well, thank you. and thank you very much for having me on to speak. I did actually do the audio book some time ago. I did it just before the release of the book in the UK, which was August last year. So it was right in the middle of that first lockdown that everybody was experiencing here. So it was quite a strange experience. Audible, who it was with, the production, they basically put up a little studio in my front room. And I had to sort of ask my family to sort of stay out of the way. And yeah, that was like 9 days that we were recording. It was a real marathon because we weren't in a proper studio, and I live in quite a rural area, and you'd think, oh, it's quiet, but no, you know, there's a small regional airport near me, so people were out flying their planes still. There were tractors going past my window and combine harvest.
I couldn't hear any of it. I'm in chapter 7 now. I can't hear any, and you read it very, very well.
Oh, we had to stop hundreds of times a day. So it was, yeah, it's the final product is very sort of smooth. But yeah, getting there was a bit of a marathon.
Wow. Well, before we get into the world of Neanderthals, let's just hear a little bit about your background. Rebecca, did you always have an interest in science and in particular Neanderthals?
I think I definitely always had an interest in the past. I was certainly one of those children who liked to sort of scrabble around and liked natural history. You know, I liked collecting things, and that included stones and old bits of pottery. If I found them in my garden, I grew up in London, so there's sort of urban archaeology there. And my family would go on holidays around to sort of, you know, heritage sites in the UK. And I was definitely drawn to imagining the past. And I do really remember one thing that sticks out. You know, like a lot of people in the UK, we grew up watching Time Team. You know, the very, very popular archaeology series that was on in the 90s and later, where they had like 3 days to dig a site. And it was, yeah, that was my real introduction to what archaeology was. And I found it fascinating. And also, I strongly remember when Ötzi the Iceman was discovered. Oh, yes. That the it's actually a copper age, I think, male body that was mummified or preserved, frozen in the ice up in the Alps. And that was like a real sort of light bulb that went off in my head, like just
they not made a just film the, about that since, haven't they?
Yeah, I haven't actually seen that, but I remember, like, yes, you're right. Yeah, I remember writing an essay for school about that, and it wasn't the mummy, the body aspect. It was the stuff he had with him that really grabbed me. And, you know, that's archaeology. It's material culture, you know. And I think that probably really made me understand the potential for what we could learn and what we might be missing about lives, human lives in prehistory. So I kind of started out a little bit more recent in time than Neanderthals. And I went on an excavation when I was 14 or 15, and that was a Roman site, Fishbourne Roman Palace, and so that was my first dig as well.
Rebecca, when was the first Neanderthal discovered and described? What is the history?
Neanderthals have actually sort of been with us since the beginning of our discovery of human origins. They were the first other kind of human, the first hominin that we really came across. And so they have been there all the way through the discipline itself evolving. But if you go back to the mid-19th century, which is just before when we first realised what Neanderthals were, there was already some understanding of geology and the sort of that the Earth was extremely old compared to traditional biblical accounts. And there was also huge interest in fossils, fossil animals. Even there had already been discoveries in the 1830s of fossil apes in Europe. Nevertheless, the first recognition of a Neanderthal fossil didn't happen until 1856, when in Germany at the Neander Valley, there was a massive marble and limestone quarry. And from a cave in this natural gorge, full of caves and cavities, and it was actually a sort of a local beauty spot that people would come to because of all these lovely formations with the river. But they, in order to actually get at the rock that they were after, they had to clear out all of sort of the deposits inside the caves. And it was from that material that the first body parts of a Neanderthal were found. It was essentially, it was the top of a skull and some pieces from the body. And they were chucked out by the miners as they were clearing this cave out. But it was the quarry foreman who recognised that they were probably not animal bones. And he alerted a local person who is interested in the history, in natural history, Johann Fulrot. And he sort of sent it up the food chain of scientists to an anatomist in Bonn. And at that point, it began to be recognised that, yes, this was some kind of human, but it didn't look like living people, and also to those individuals, it didn't look as if it was, just deformed. It looked like something else. And
that foreman turned out to be like a champion of science, unwittingly.
Well, exactly. I mean, it is quite interesting that many of the early discoveries, not just of Neanderthals, but other prehistoric findings, some of them were linked to, industry and extraction of aggregates or building of railways and things like this. So the industrialization of Europe was definitely part of that. But at the same time, other people had been going into caves since the 1830s. And the first Neanderthal that we know of that was actually excavated or found was in the 1830s in Belgium, but it wasn't recognised as a Neanderthal till later. So that was somebody who was going in who had an interest in fossils and wanted to know, more. So that wasn't the same context as the Neanderthal discovery in a big quarry. But surely there must have been other people randomly coming across bits of Neanderthals in the past. We just won't know about it. That's lost to history.
Yeah, I mean, I think of when it was Australopithecus sediba that was discovered because they were blowing up bits of the ground looking for limestone or something like that.
Yeah, in South Africa, there's a lot of different contexts like that for the same reason, quarrying and extraction. And it's an interesting question, what motivates people to actually go and dig up caves or be in caves in the first place? And we know that Neanderthals, they lived near the entrances of caves, but they also were exploring deep caves on occasion. So that's kind of interesting. Like, what remains did they come across as well themselves?
Absolutely. Right. Let's now have a mini crash course in Neanderthals. So how would you describe the species in terms of when they existed, what they looked like, how they differed from Homo sapiens, and where their species may have come from?
Yeah, essentially, I think for a lot of people, if they don't know that much about human origins, because of the way that Neanderthals have been framed for a long time as sort of the other to us, they may think, oh, Neanderthals are like a missing link with a very, very ancient kind of hominin. And that's not really the case. The first sort of members of the hominin family, really, you're talking 3-4 plus million years ago, and the first stone tool technology that we have found so far is about 3.3 million years ago, whereas the Neanderthals don't split off from our shared ancestor with them until somewhere between about 760 to 550,000 years ago. So it's way more recent. So they're actually quite close to us chronologically. And we have a shared ancestor, and then there's a divergence, and the lineage that would become us goes one way, the lineage that would become Neanderthals goes another way. And when we kind of go on parallel sort of evolutionary paths, but they're pretty similar in terms of the overall body development and stuff. So Neanderthals, you know, they're not a missing link to apes or anything extremely primitive in terms of their bodies. Overall, they're very similar to us. They are slightly shorter, but, you know, by a couple of inches, 3 inches, and not a lot. Their bodies are stockier. The bones themselves are thicker. And there are some obvious shape differences as well. If you look at the skeleton in detail, for example, the pelvis, the hip bones, are shaped differently. The ribs of Neanderthals flare out more down towards their waist, so our waists kind of tuck in a little bit. Theirs don't really do that. They look more sort of barrel-chested. And obviously, I mean, they stood upright just as we do. They walked fully on two legs. There's no question about that. But I think one of the clearest differences is in the skull. So they have, overall, the capacity of their brain case is basically exactly the same as ours. The shape, though, is what's different. So Neanderthals don't have, you know, this very vertical chin straight up to the forehead thing that we have going on. The front of their face is pulled forward more, and they don't have a forehead that is so straight. Theirs kind of goes back more, so it's kind of more aerodynamic. Whereas we have like much more of a balloon shaped head. You know, that's unusual. We are the weirdos in that sense for having this very round head. And like they had a little knobble at the back of their head that stuck out, but their face is just big as well. They had larger eyes. The nasal aperture, so that's the hole where the nose comes out, it's very big. So they probably had really quite sort of impressive faces. But we can see these features, you know, you can even see it in newborn babies. You know, they're lacking the chin. They didn't really have chins. That you can see that in newborns as well. And some of the other sort of the different proportions of the body, it's already there. But on the other hand, some aspects like the robustness of the bones, the thickness and the heaviness of the bones, some of that might be to do with the intensity of their lifestyles as well, because just through huge amounts of exercise, and also sometimes to do with temperature, that can sort of create a more robust body. But certainly there are genetic differences for sure in terms of how they developed physically.
Is it true that only Homo sapiens have a chin, or have I got that wrong?
Yes. I mean, the odd Neanderthal here and there, especially later and in the Near East, they look like they might have a little chin, but that might be to do with interbreeding. Which is a whole other sort of kettle of fish. In terms of the classic form, yes, they lack a chin. You know, you can feel yours very distinct. So they don't have that. We have what makes our face flat is that the bone cells here, are they like they're absorbing bone cells, whereas Neanderthal bone cells here are growing. So as the front of the face is pulled forward a bit, they actually had a space at the between the back tooth and the jaw as well. So that's because it's been pulled forward. So there are all these little differences that are to do with how they develop, and some of them sort of relate to others and have knock-on effects and things like that.
Rebecca, you go into quite a bit of detail in your book about the various technologies that Neanderthals used. This means stone tools, spears, scrapers for use on animal hides, and so forth. Now, in terms of these tools, what do we now think worked best for these people? What technologies might they have mastered?
Well, certainly Neanderthals were, I would say, artisans in how they understood stone and other materials, actually. They understood material properties very well. So whether you're talking about working stone, we call that napping, or carving things out of wood or other materials, they really sort of got that different sorts of stone have different properties, and the same with wood, and also in how you treat them will give you a different product. So in terms of their technologies, their stone technologies, which we call lithic technology, the Neanderthals are part of what we call as archaeologists the middle Paleolithic. So Paleolithic is sort of just the whole period to the earliest stone tools up to around 10,000 years ago, when technologies changed a little bit and it was the end of the last ice age. But Neanderthals are defined really by developing what we call prepared core technology, where before Neanderthals, there was the simplest kind of stone technology where you have a block, and you may place that on the ground and then hit pieces off it. So it's kind of like an anvil. And that's what we find like 3.5 million years ago, or 3.3. Not long after that, by about 2 million years ago, there's already quite sophisticated understanding of the angles that you need when you hold a piece of stone and actually strike it to take flakes off. And we can see sort of circular patterns of them taking stone off as they turn it around, flip it over, take another one. That's a technique that requires an understanding of geometry and angles and knowing how the stone will respond. So that's already quite ancient. And that technology, which is referred to partly to as a discoidal napping, because the cores sometimes are kind of like shaped like a disc, that goes right on through. And Neanderthals did that too. It's very efficient. And later Homo sapiens used it as well now and then. But as well as that, you have what people probably recognize as a really distinctive kind of artifact called hand axes or bifaces, which are worked on two sides, basically. So those are the iconic kind of tear-shaped objects that people will be familiar with. And that is like a step further on in a way, in that you are working with something which has two different faces. You have like a plane, a geometric plane that goes through that rock, and you shape one side, shape the other. Some of those flakes that come off are useful too. So that's another kind of technology. And that emerges around 1.8 million years ago, something like that. And again, that carried on. Neanderthals used that too, although theirs were a little bit sort of made slightly differently, but the concept is the same. What Neanderthals did, and also early Homo sapiens, or the species or the populations before early Homo sapiens evolved in Africa, we see a shift where instead of sort of just taking bits off, what you do is you actually shape your core. So you create a surface. You have a hierarchy, basically. So you have an upper surface, which is where the stuff you want is going to come off, but you shape around the edges and the bottom, and that allows you to control what comes off the top. And then you sort of take a final blow and something nice and big will come off. And that's called prepared core technology. And in Europe, we call it Levallois. It's named after a French suburb of Paris. But essentially, that allows Neanderthals to have a much better control of the products that they're getting off. And in particular, it allows them to get big flakes, which are also really thin, much thinner than a hand axe. These are the big double-sided things. And that's really useful if you are moving around the landscape a lot more, because as you travel around, you may want to resharpen the tools that you have. So, you know, you can keep them going for longer. It's more efficient. And if you have a big, thin flake, it's easier to do that than having a massive core, because if you, a double-sided biface, if you resharpen that too much, your angles get messed up and eventually you just can't take any more off and it becomes like a useless lump of rock. So you've wasted the effort of carrying around that heavy lump. So having a lot of flakes makes a lot more sense in energetic terms, and it allows you to, the landscape basically becomes opened up to you in a new way. It promotes higher mobility, and we know that Neanderthals were doing that because we can see from the kinds of rock that they use, we compare it to the source, we can track that the distances that they moved were greater than the hominin populations before them. So that's the key difference, really, in one of the major aspects of what Neanderthals did.
Yes, and obviously they had a long time, 300,000 plus years of existence to refine this. So it's very impressive, really.
Yeah, and they didn't just do that. This is one of the things that's really important, what I hoped to do with the book, which is to get rid of this idea that Neanderthals just did that and that's all they did, and then they just carried on doing that from when they emerged like 300,000 years ago until when they disappear 40,000 years ago. And in fact, what we now know from archaeology is that, yes, they had Lavawa, but they had many kinds of Lavawa, and they did other cool things. They had different kinds of discoid. They developed their own sort of idiosyncratic ways of taking apart stone, depending on exactly the kind of products they needed. They had whole sequences of reducing rock in a particular way, and then they would take it to another site and do a bit more, take it somewhere else. And they were very flexible according to the circumstances they were in. And one of the things that people some time ago used to claim was a real difference was that Homo sapiens developed blade technology, basically, as like a new sexy thing. And blades are basically just long, thin flakes, so like twice as long as they are wide. Neanderthals could do those too. We know that they did that. They didn't focus on it. It wasn't the key thing that they were always interested in, but they could certainly make blades. They could even make little bladelets, tiny little bits. So
they know what worked, didn't they? I mean, the impression that people have is they were very static and they just did the same thing and never changed, but they knew what worked and there were variations of what worked.
Yeah, and it was the way that they worked stone and wood and other materials. It's systematic. You know, it's not that they're not sort of just randomly bashing stuff. There's always intentionality in what they're up to. And it very strongly appears as if they are thinking ahead, at least to some extent, in that they are expecting to take some of their objects with them and carry them and need to resharpen them. So when that happens, they take the biggest pieces, the biggest flakes with them, because if you resharpen those over time, they get smaller. So it makes sense to take the biggest one if you expect to have to resharpen it a lot. So we can kind of see these little threads that point out to us the fact that they are flexible, they are innovative, but they are also quite systematic in what they do.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, and welcome to Hiss and Tell, a cat podcast where we delve deep into the fascinating world of feline behavior with your host, me, Christina Wilson, a professional animal behaviorist. Each episode features insightful discussions with leading veterinarians, dedicated researchers and scientists, experts in cat behavior and training, and so much more. Join me as we decode the complexities of pet loss, unravel the mysteries of feline health and behavior, and discover the latest research findings. I'll meet you at Hiss and Tell.
The first Neanderthal face to emerge from time's sarcophagus was a woman's. As the social and liberal revolutions of 1848 began convulsing Europe, quarry workers' rough hands pulled her from the great rock of Gibraltar.
Well, not too long ago, you wrote an article entitled "Sheanderthal" about female Neanderthals and what we know about them. Now, so many of the reconstructions of Neanderthals that we see in museums are usually of males, but female remains have been identified, such as the Altai woman of Siberia. So what do we know about the lives of Neanderthal women?
Yeah, it's actually quite appropriate because today is International Women's Day.
Wow, fantastic.
So it's good to talk about it. Well, it is true that in a lot of the reconstruction images, if you go right back to the mid-19th century, when people started to draw and imagine what Neanderthals were like, and they would make paintings or engravings and things like this, for a long time, if there was even like a female there in the image, then they would be like in the background skulking in a cave and not really doing a lot. Or if they were doing something, then it was usually going to be something to do with skin working, or, you know, that's down on the ground and looking pretty sort of drudgy.
So there was this old image of the male dragging them by the hair back to the cave.
Oh, I think that's like a 1950s trope.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. I think that's a lot later. It's quite interesting. Yeah. You know, dragging women back to the kitchen after the war. There's kind of an interesting social thing there. In terms of what we actually know about Neanderthals and women, it's quite complicated in archaeology until we had genetics to actually identify female bodies. When you literally just have skeletons, what you really need is the pelvis. Because in men and women, the pelvis shape is different to allow for the presence of the birth canal and things like this. So if you lack a pelvis, the hip bones, it's quite difficult. And what you would then do is try, if you had like a site with multiple Neanderthals in, you would basically look for the ones that are a bit smaller and a bit more lightly built. Of course, that is based on averages. Yes, on average, men are slightly taller and heftier than women, but not always. You know, everybody knows tall women or whatever. So whenever that was being used, that was always, you know, with caveats. But since we've had the advent of ancient DNA studies and genetics, that has allowed us to identify female Neanderthals based on the presence of a sex chromosome, so the X chromosome. So that's been quite useful, because in some cases it's allowed us to confirm the ID of female Neanderthals that we thought were female based on, you know, how robust they were and things like this. So that's kind of nice. And one of the key examples of that is the Forbes Quarry Neanderthal, which was one of these very early ones found in the 19th century before the Neanderthal discovery. This was from Gibraltar. So she lived around 90,000 years ago. We only have her skull, actually. She's also interesting because there has been this trope for a long time that Neanderthals all died really young, you know, that they never sort of got past the 30s or whatever. And that's really not true. She was in, you know, 40s plus and, you know, potentially older. It's quite hard as skeletons get older. The older they get, the harder it is to be sure about exactly how ancient in terms of their lives they actually were. But she certainly was older than 40. Could well have been a grandmother, but we can't tell that at the moment from bodies, although there is work underway to do that. But in terms of how Neanderthal women overall lived, given the identifications that we have, and actually we don't have that many clear ones, what we can see is that the Neanderthal women that we do have were just as physically active as men. So they were very strong, physically capable, clearly having, you know, intensive lives. But there are hints that they were using their bodies in a different way. So one of the things that's interesting is that the development of the leg bones are different to the development of the male leg bones. And that might be implying that the kind of terrain that they moved over habitually was different. So although it's really, really difficult to kind of pick out for sure what was going on, there does seem to be some kind of difference. And it may be that males were more regularly traversing very rough terrain, although it is hard to be sure exactly, but there is a difference. And we can see something in the arm bones as well, where for Neanderthal males, I mean, Neanderthals overall were 90% of them were right-handed, just as we are. And the dominant arm usually is the one that's more sort of developed. But we can see in Neanderthal males that the asymmetry between one arm and the other in terms of its muscle development and everything is really quite strong. It's what you would see in like people who regularly play tennis at like a really high level, you know, or cricket, things like this, where you're using a bat or something in one hand that's being used really regularly. Whereas for the female Neanderthals, although again the samples are quite small, there does seem to be less asymmetry. So whatever they're doing with their arms, they're tending to use both arms together more often than the males. So there does seem to be something different there. And teeth as well. We can see what Neanderthals were doing with their teeth. They weren't just eating stuff thanks to different kinds of useware on their teeth. So sort of the way that using their mouths as a tool actually wears the teeth down. Both males and females were using their mouths a lot to do stuff with. But again, the kind of patterning of the wear in terms of what it looks like and where it is in the mouth is a bit different. So there may also be something going on there that where Neanderthal women are and what they're doing on average is different to the males. But we really have to remember that not only are the sample size quite small, that Neanderthals are not monolithic. You know, we say, oh, the Neanderthals, but they not only lived across this huge chronological span, they also lived, which is important because they survived many periods of different kinds of climates, which affects the kind of world they live in, but they also live in a geographically large area. So from where I am in Wales, right across to the Near East, down in the Mediterranean, Central Asia, and up into Siberia. So the kinds of lives that they're living varies a lot. And those signals in terms of sex differences may be different. We should expect them to be different according to the kind of world that they're living in. So those are things that it would be amazing to tease that out further in the future, but we need larger, more sort of clear identification of more females to really sort of start to home in on that.
Well, we can't really talk about Neanderthals without mentioning the amazing DNA work done in recent years. So do you find that people are even more interested in Neanderthals now that we know that so many of us carry their DNA?
Yeah, for sure. I think how people relate to them has changed all the way through sort of since their first discovery. I think they fulfilled the role of sort of the other, something that's close to us but not close to us, and that we wish to know but we also wish to keep at a distance. That's been there from the beginning, and they have been one of the best known, probably the best known and the most popular hominin for an awfully long time. And you can see that, you know, in popular culture, you know, references to them, their place in literature and things like this. But since the advent of ancient genetics and the recognition in 2010, so it's actually only, 11 years now, nearly 11 years, since it was confirmed that there actually had been interbreeding between Neanderthals and us, and that a genetic legacy from them is still in most living people today. Ever since that, I think people really have had a renewed interest in them, from feeling a connection to them that perhaps wasn't there before. But I mean, it does get problematic. And, you know, what's interesting is that whenever I encounter people who have had a genetic test themselves, they will say, oh, I had some Neanderthal DNA, it's really cool. Or they'd be like, oh, I had more than most people. And they're like pleased about it.
4%.
It's between, it's up sort of, I think it's 1.2 to 2 and a bit percent now. So it's not as much as it used to be thought. It used to be thought maybe 4%, but the percentage has gone down a bit. But most, people seem pleased to have that association. And I think on a basic level, it's because people are just interested to be connected to an ancient past, you know, in a very fluffy kind of ethereal way.
And it's a well-known hominid, isn't it? So.
Yes, but on the other hand, people who Neanderthals have kind of been drawn into slightly...
The Biden comment.
Well, I mean, there is the whole using the word Neanderthal as an insult. I don't know when that started, but certainly it's alive and kicking and people are quite happy to say that. But I'm interested as to whether the same people that will use that word actually use it in a dissociated way from the Neanderthals. And I think actually overall there is a reasonable basic understanding that Neanderthals weren't quite as, you know, stupid as we framed them to be for a long time. You know, whether or not people know the detail about Neanderthals, they kind of understand that concept. Yeah. And yet that insult remains. I think it's become divorced actually from the archaeology, which is interesting. But there is also another whole thing going on with the genetics in that people who are essentially white nationalists who for some time were very keen to claim a deep European ancestry for themselves and say, oh, well, I've got so much hunter-gatherer DNA in me and all of this. Now they're like, well, I've got loads of Neanderthal DNA and Neanderthals were all white. And no, Neanderthals were not all white. There's variation from what we understand in their skin colour. We don't believe that they were ever very, very dark skinned, but they weren't super pale, you know.
I'm looking at the wonderful art behind you by Tom Bjorklund, which
illustrate
the Neanderthal article.
Yes. So there is something else odd going on in terms of people are interested in claiming Neanderthals for themselves. So there's the whole genetics thing, but you can also see it in other contexts. For example, on, you know, who has access to the fossils that come from one country, but they're in a museum in another country and things like that. So, I mean, Britain, I think, is dealing with a claim from Gibraltar to have the Forbes woman and another Neanderthal child, not from the same site as her, but from Gibraltar, to have those remains sent back to Gibraltar. So it is interesting. People wish to sort of possess them now.
A few years back, you and some colleagues founded a group called Trowel Blazers. So what can you tell us about this group?
We founded ourselves officially in 2013. So it's quite back in the day when, we all didn't have children and things like this. But no, myself, Brenna Hassett, Victoria Herridge, and Suzanne Pilar Birch, so the four of us, as what we were then, early career researchers, so people who are not long out of their PhD and just beginning in academia and research, we got together. We met on Twitter, actually, and decided to form a group in order to promote the presence and sort of highlight the role of women in archaeology and the earth sciences, so geology and paleontology. So me, Susie and Brenna are archaeologists, and Tori is a paleobiologist, so she specializes in dwarf mammoths and elephants. We started the group basically because there wasn't a easily accessible non-academic resource collating sort of women's contributions to these fields. So we wanted to do that, and we set up a website, trowelblazers.com, which has been going. I think we did the website 2015. We actually set up. We started off with a Tumblr, you know, back when people did Tumblrs.
Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah. So, but now we have I think well over 220 mini biographies of women, you know, with nice pictures and stuff, and just short pieces talking about people's work. But one of the things that really jumped out at us is the A, that there were a lot more women around, even if you go right back to the early 20th century and beyond, than people might expect. And also that they were not working in isolation. You know, they weren't anomalies, like, oh, one woman among loads and loads of men. There were networks of connection between these women as well. So they would be mentoring or training or actually collaborating with each other. So there was sort
it's
of
not always
ecosystem.
A Mary Anning sort of situation, is it?
Yeah, I mean, even Mary Anning is interesting because she is, you know, she's still described as a woman in history forgot, but actually people have kind of been talking about Mary Anning quite a lot for the past decade, I'd say. And she's a lot better known than she used to be. She's in a lot of children's books. Exactly, with that film Ammonite. But she also was not isolated, although the way that you would think it, because nobody ever talks about anyone she knew, but she did have women she worked with in Lyme Regis, where she lived in Dorset, in the early 19th century. She had a neighbour, Elizabeth Philpott, who was better off than her and didn't have to sell her fossils. So she had her own little museum, but they used to go out collecting every day, virtually every day. So she had her. But Mary Anning was also connected to not only the learned men interested in fossils and paleontology who would come to her and buy the stuff that she had collected, but she also knew their wives, many of whom were independently interested in this, and one of whom, the story of the film Ammonite, which just came out this year, is based on, although it plays with the truth a little bit, it is true that Charlotte Murchison what came to Lyme Regis and was trained in fossiling by Mary Anning. So that is true. Wow. So yeah, even for Mary Anning, she wasn't isolated. And you can trace these mini networks out from different women all the way through to the present day. And there's, like, you know, you can see generational connections between who trained who and then where they went. And that includes people that worked on Neanderthals as well. Dorothy Garrod is a great example. She was the first Oxbridge professor, first woman Oxbridge professor to hold a chair in Britain. She was awarded that in 1939, by which time she had already excavated two Neanderthals, one of whom was that child's fossil I mentioned from Gibraltar, the Devil's Tower boy, and another one she dug up in 1932, or rather her team did, from Mount Carmel in what was Palestine then. So, yeah, all these different connections in the kind of work that I'm interested in.
Fascinating. Well, this has been such an incredible dive into the world of Neanderthals. We know an incredible amount about these people, but still have so much yet to discover. But with your book, Kindred, the world knows a whole lot more. So what about future projects? Rebecca, is there anything not too secret you can tell us about?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm having the most amazing time talking about the book. Here it is, doing your great podcast and lots of others. And I can't wait for the current restrictions that everybody's living under to be lifted, so I can actually go and meet people and you know, go and do some proper live events. That's going to be amazing. And then the paperback is out in August as well. So there'll be that. But in terms of, other projects, we're always doing stuff at Trailblazers. We have different projects kind of on the boil there. But in terms of my work, I've got some academic writing that I'm doing at the moment, doing a chapter on Neanderthal sexual biology, which is interesting. That's co-written, that chapter, what we know basically about their reproduction and things. And I'm also writing a chapter about the changes in representations of Neanderthals over time. So that's going to be interesting as well. But yeah, other projects, I would like to write another book. I am doing a proposal on that at the moment, and it's going to be a lot bigger in scope and sort of chronology. It's archaeology still. It's still human origins, but I haven't got far enough down the line to kind of give too many details about that. But yes, no, I've although I am you know, coming from a scientific context and a background, it's been absolutely incredible to write a book like this. And, you know, if people read it, they'll see that, you know, I've kind of tried to go to do more than just science and really place people in the past. You know, at the beginning of the chapters, I have little narrative sections and things kind of setting scenes.
It's beautifully written, I must say.
Oh, thank you. And that has been lovely to do that. And I want to pursue that aspect of it, because it's always interested me, writing. So I want to keep doing both.
I will leave links to your website and social media in the description below. And hopefully we can have you back on Evolution Soup one day in the very near future.
Thank you so much for having me. And I hope everybody's enjoyed listening.